f mu nu, which meant minus 1 over 4 g squared integral over 4x f mu nu a in terms of the component of the field strength tensor, where the field strength tensor is defined in terms of the component of the field as f mu nu equal d mu a nu minus d nu a mu minus I times the commutator of a mu a nu. And remember that a mu is in fact a multiplet of gauge field with the indices a going from 1 to n, which is the dimension of the gauge group. And this is the commutator in terms of the generator of the gauge group. So in fact, we write in terms of a matrix representation, this is this way, okay? Where TA are the generator of the group. And we saw that in order to compute a functional integral, we had to implement a gauge fixing condition in order to treat in a consistent way the enormous degrees of freedom associated to gauge transformation. And remember, gauge transformation are defined as I change a mu into g, a mu g minus 1 minus I g d mu g minus 1, where g is an element of the group g. And in terms of infinitesimal transformation, this will be important in the following. If I write that g is 1 plus I times alpha, where alpha is an element of the Lie algebra of the group, so alpha writes like that, alpha equal alpha a ta in terms of the component, the generator of the Lie algebra, generators. We have that a mu transform into a mu plus the covariant derivative with respect to the gauge field mu of alpha, namely this is the covariant derivative acting on the representation, which is the adjoint representation. So it is simply a mu plus d, the ordinary derivative d mu of alpha minus I times the commutator of e mu with alpha. Okay. So now we are interested in computing some object like a functional integral, which is an integral of a dA of exponential of I times the action, and possibly times some observable, if we are interested in computing expectation value in the vacuum of observable of the gauge theory, which is what ultimately we are interested in. Okay, so we have seen that in order to do that, in fact, the correct way to proceed is to introduce a gauge fixing condition. So we introduce the gauge fixing condition. Which is largely arbitrary, and which takes the general form that we have some function of that I call f for gauge fixing. We have some function of the field and of its derivative at a given point, at any point x. So let me specify. I have a set of n gauge fixing condition for each component of the gauge field, which takes its general form. And FAA of X mean, in fact, that this is a function in general, it's a function of a of x, dA of x, possibly some other derivative, but it's a local function in general of the field. And as an example, I shall be considering the following functional. FA of x will be defined in my case as the ordinary derivative of A mu x minus some function A of x. So, of course, I have. So, I have a choice of n function omega of x, which are at the moment fixed. There is some arbitrariness in the choice of my gauge fixing condition. And I just fix the value of the covariant divergence of the gauge field in each component. And it has the advantage to be Lorentz invariant. Lorentz invariant. But of course, you may have considering other gauge fixing conditions. Okay? And we have seen that if we do that after a set of manipulation, we end up that this functional integral is equal to another functional integral where I take into account the gauge fixing condition. So I call A, just remember, A is a set of all gauge fixing configuration. And now I have taken into account the fact that I can impose this gauge fixing condition because the action is gauge invariant. And I assume I have been able to consider a measure which is also gauge invariant. Otherwise, the theory is not gauge invariant. So it doesn't make sense to define a functional integral of an invariant gauge series with a measure which is not gauge invariant. So I assume that it is gauge invariant. And then we ended up with a beautiful formula, which was that I can introduce the constraint in the functional integral. I fixed f of a to be equal to 0, f of a to be equal to 0. This means that I fixed this delta function is a compact way to mean that for any x and for any a, f a of x for the given a here is equal to 0. So it's a Dirac function in a big space. Depending on for all x and a, okay, and then in order to take into account the fact that if you integrate naively by enforcing the gauge by a delta function, this will give the measure term which depend on f. So this is not gauge invariance because it depends on the choice of the gauge fixing condition. I have to take this into account by a measure term, which is this famous determinant. So I have the absolute value of a big determinant. And this is a determinant of an infinite dimensional matrix, if you want, which is the derivative, and let me find my correct notation. This corresponds to take the functional derivative. So I consider the derivative of f of a when I'm making a gauge transformation. So by doing a gauge transformation here, I know that I'm moving A into A transformed by the element G of the gauge fixing. So you know that F of A is zero, but if I make a small gauge transformation by a group element H on A, F of H will be different from zero. And so I take the derivative of this function with respect to all the possible gauge fixing in all direction, if you want. So it's a big operator, and I take the determinant of this operator, and I have to take the absolute value. And of course, then I have, since this is gauge invariant, I have not changed anything. And I just add in front of that a constant term, which was the volume of the gauge group that I will neglect because it's just a constant. So this is this famous Fadeyev-Popov Feynman DeWitt determinant. Okay. And this is quite formal. So let us check what is this operator and what does this determinant means for this explicit example. Okay. So for this explicit example, I do have that. Oh, I forgot only. Yes. So I'm considering this function f of a, which is in that case. F means that I'm computing d mu a mu a of x minus omega a of x. See? So this is the f of a. Now I am performing, I perform a gauge transformation by a factor. I am transforming a into ah, where h will be 1 plus I delta alpha. So h ta. I make a small infinitesimal transformation. So I delta alpha ta is in fact what is called delta h here. So this is the original h, and this is delta h. So I can write that this is 1 plus delta h, if you want. And what is then delta a mu? So if I make an infinitesimal transformation like that, we have seen that a becomes a plus delta a with delta a. And now, in fact, if I work in component, delta a mu is given by this component. This is d mu of, I should have written, it would be more convenient not to switch here. So let me redo this here. I am computing an infinitesimal transformation h equal 1 plus delta h with delta h equal delta alpha a of x, of course. I'm performing a local gauge transformation. Under such a transformation, the gauge field transform it to A plus delta A, where delta A is given by the formula immediately here. This is d mu of delta. And if I write in terms of component, d mu, so delta A mu A of x is equal to the A component of this. So this is d mu of alpha A of x. So this is d mu, the ordinary derivative of alpha A of x, minus I times the commutator. And the commutator, remember, is simply I will get minus f b c a a mu b of x,
And there is a delta alpha, sorry, d mu delta alpha, delta alpha c of x.
Remember, the commutator of, I'm using the fact that the commutator of TA and TB is by, of TA and TB is by definition I time F ABC TC, where TC are the structure constant. So in fact, I rather get here BC plus, if I am right. You see? Pardon?
Is there an I in the first one?
There is an I here?
No, not there. Well, where are you defining?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. You see? OK, so this is the explicit expression for the variation of the gauge potential, the gauge field, under a small variation of h. Okay. So now, let us see, what is the variation of f? This is f a of x. So what is the variation of delta f a of x for this, under such a variation of A? The variation of the gauge condition is obviously, since the gauge condition is just the covariant divergence minus a constant term, this term doesn't change, and you get simply d mu of delta a mu of x. Therefore, you get d mu of delta alpha a of x plus f b c a of d mu of these products of a b mu of x and of delta alpha c of x. So d mu acts on both terms. You see? OK. So now, yes?
Why the variation of the function O w is 0?
Yes. What?
Why the variation of the function w is 0?
The variation of the function
w.
Because W is chosen to be just a fixed constant. I've chosen some function. It can be 0. It can be some function in space. It's just a function which doesn't change. It has nothing to do with A. Yeah.
Okay.
Let us take it to be 0, for instance. So then you get what is called the Lorentz gauge in electrodynamics, d mu and mu equals 0. So omega is just an arbitrary choice of function. Okay. So this is the variation of the gauge. And you see that even if you start from an A which satisfies the gauge condition, in general, this is in general non-zero. Okay. So what is this big operator, this delta F AH over delta H, what does it mean? It means simply that I am taking the term which is over the delta alpha A. So it means that I'm considering the function F A of A H to a point X, and I'm considering what is the variation of this object if I make a variation of h which is of the form I delta alpha b of y. So you see, it's a determinant where the variation, you change all the alpha b of y at any point, and you see what is the effect of making a change on alpha b of y on fa of x. You see? So you see, this is in fact the ratio of those two variations will be just the kernel. It will be the integral kernel. Kernel of an operator acting on function depending both of a point x in space-time and with a component in the Lie algebra of the group. Okay, so it will be something, some big things. I can call it G because it's a Jacobian matrix. It's a Jacobian matrix which depends both on A on B, you see, and on the points X and Y. Okay. And so this is the kernel of this operator. And here I have an explicit expression of this kernel, because I see that this is simply, here I have a first term where I have a delta alpha A, so here I have a delta AB, because I have the same index A here, and here I have just the Laplace operator. This is the Laplace operator. Laplace operator on d mu, acting on functions. You see? But now I have this other terms, which is plus, and now I have a term which contains information on the structure of the group, because I have the structure constant. And I have to be just a bit careful, because here I have to intervert the index C and B, because here I am considering what is delta alpha. Oh, let us just assume that I'm having C here instead of B. This would be, because here I have a delta alpha C, and then I have a delta F, and I can use the antisymmetry to write this is FABC, and then I have the operator d mu, you see, acting to the right, because it acts here on A mu B. You see? So this is the operator. I have an operator. Here, if I have a function, I plug a function here. I multiplied, which will be the function alpha c of y. I multiply it by a mu b. I take the derivative. And then I take care of the group indices by the antisymmetric factor. Yes? Yeah, so this means that this is a fact, of course. So this is an operator, and I'm taking the xy element. This means that I am applying this to a delta function of x and y. So it's an integral kernel of an operator. This operator is, in fact, a differential operator. Operator. Exactly like the operator we have been considering in the quantization of the free field, you see? Simply, it involves not only the Laplace operator, but it involves also a term which involves only one derivative, the gauge potential. So since delta acts on that, you can rewrite this as d mu a mu. Of course, this is d mu with a mu. Up in the index, you have a d mu a mu plus an a mu times d mu. Okay, because you can rewrite d mu a mu b as d mu a mu b, which is a function, plus a mu b d mu, which is a differential operator. So it contains both the derivative part and the constant part, which depend on x through the dependence on the. So it's a complicated Laplace operator. So we have an integral kernel of a differential operator, and we have to compute its determinant and to take the absolute value. So the question is, how do we compute the determinant of this differential operator? Yes?
The del arrow, because when we take the derivative of mu alpha, and we take it becomes del mu alpha, but when we take the functional derivative, like del alpha of the derivative, we can just say that alpha goes away.
No, because you are considering, okay, you can. This means simply that I can rewrite that delta f alpha that I've written here. I can rewrite the delta f a of x as an integral over dy, d for y, times gac of x and y, times delta alpha c of y. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So, GAC of XY is just defined to be the kernel here, which gives the delta FA given by this formula. And you see the delta AC doesn't go away. So this a bit more formal and more compact expression is just another way to rewrite the variation of delta FA in terms of the variation of delta alpha through this formula, which is the very definition of what is the integral kernel of an operator. Okay? So how do we compute the determinant of this operator? So here comes a beautiful trick of this gentleman, which is to introduce auxiliary anti-commuting fields, which are known as the famous ghosts and anti-ghosts fields. Okay? And I explain what are those ghosts. Nothing to do with the spiritual world. Remember, we have seen that, go back to the lecture on the quantization of fermions, real fermions, fermions with both obey the Fermi statistics and who have spin. We have seen that if you have a set of anti-commuting variables, theta I and theta bar I, and if you have a matrix AIG, we can write the determinant of A of the matrix as an integral over the Grassmann variables of exponential of minus theta I AIG, theta G with the theta bar here. Okay, this is a general formula which allows to express what is the determinant of a matrix or of an operator in terms of the Grassmann integral. And the trick is to use that to compute this determinant. Okay. So, but one warning. Here, we have the absolute value of the determinant. So, can we go from the absolute value of the determinant of this G operator to the determinant. Because this trick works for determinant, it doesn't work for absolute values of determinant. If the determinant changes sign, the results of the functional integral of this integral change of sign. While here, we don't want it to change of sign. So we can apply this trick if the determinant doesn't change of sign. So, but you have to think a little bit. What does it mean if the determinant of the G's change of sign? Remember, we had this big picture at the beginning where we had the space of all gauge configuration. We had those orbits of the gauge group. Okay. And we had this gauge fixing condition. We had FA equals 0 was giving a slice on this space. And in fact, you have to realize that the determinants of the G operators measure what's happening you have to take into account the fact that here the measure is this, while here the measure is this. And so you can see that, in fact, if the determinant changes sign, it has to go through 0. And the determinant, to mean that the determinant goes to 0 means that at some point you are doing something like that. So if you have, in some direction, of course, it's an infinite, the orbits are infinite dimensional. But in some direction in the space of Gauge transformation, something happens like that, then the determinant of G is equal to 0 because some of the eigenvalues of G goes to 0. And that's very bad because you see that in that case, you have two different equivalent field configuration, you see, which are gauge equivalent. So you are counting twice. Here I'm counting twice the same physical configuration. Okay. So it means that the gauge fixing is not working well. It's working well locally. If you look at what's happening locally in the space of gauge configuration, but it's not working globally. You have some configuration of the gauge which looks very different because they are far apart in the space of gauge configuration, but in fact, which are physically equivalent. Yes?
Does this mean that the differential operator cannot have a zero mode?
Yeah, so it means that at this point, for this precise value of A here, not for all value of A, but for this precise value of A, this differential operator has a zero eigenvalue, which means a zero mode. And the determinant change of size. Yes?
So this means that the determinant cannot be complex?
The?
Like we said that to change the sign, the determinant should pass zero.
Yes.
So we assume that the determinant is real.
It becomes negative.
No. Like this kind of argument.
Yes.
So to change sign, it passes zero. This means that we assume that the determinant is real.
Yes, in this case, it is real. You see, everything here is real. The gauge field is real. The components of the gauge field are real. The structure constant of the group are real. So everything is real. So it's a real operator. So,
It's not quite obvious. I mean, because like we have differential operators, and if we go to momentum space, one of them, like one of them is of a second order and the other is of first
yes.
order, and one of them will have I.
Yeah, oh, okay, I see what you mean. Well, but in fact, the important is whether this operator is Hermitian. And well, I think it's real, but it's perhaps a bit more.
Are the structure constants real?
Ah.
The structure coefficients of the Lie group, are they real?
For SU2, they are real. They are just the epsilon ABC.
Then it should be real because it's written in terms of only real objects?
Yes.
So it has to be real?
Okay, we'll check whether we get a sensible result or that later on when we compute the determinant. But I think it's real. So either I have forgotten an I or there is something. It's something. No, but it's real. It acts on real function and transforms them into real function. So it's a real. It's perhaps not Hermitian. It's perhaps not symmetric, but it's real. So it may have complex eigenvalues. But okay, but let us not discuss that further. Okay, so you see, let us come back to this. So you see that you are counting twice the same physical configuration, and this is a phenomenon which is called as Gribov copies. Because in fact, in gauge theories, you can prove that with some gauge fixing condition, you have indeed Gribov copies. So copies in equivalent field configuration, which are the same. Okay. But so let us assume that we don't encounter this problem, and let us continue the calculation. If we continue the calculation, we can replace the absolute value of the determinant by the determinant itself. At most, we'll get a sign wrong, but it will cancel between the numerator and the denominator. And let us continue. Or if we continue, we end up with. So now what do we have to do? We have to replace the theta i's and the theta g by. So instead of having theta i's and theta g and theta bar g, we will introduce anti-commuting fields, and I will replace Ci by a field that I called the theta A. I replace it by a field C, which is in fact Ca of X, which I call the ghost. And the theta bar will be replaced by a field, a conjugate field, a Dirac, if you want, a Dirac, or it's rather a Fermi conjugate because we have no spins here. It's a conjugate field C, which means that I call C bar A of X, which is called the anti-ghost. Okay, and you see, at that level, they are very much like the anti-commuting field we associated to the Fermi, the Dirac field for quantizing fermion, except that those fields, C A of X and C bar of X, they carry group indices, but they do not carry Dirac or Lorentz indices. Okay. And then we write the determinant of G simply as an integral over D of C bar and C, exactly in the same way. This will mean simply a product over X, products over A of D C bar A of X D C A of X, where this is the usual definition of the Grassmann integration. Grassmann integration. Okay, and I write exponential of, and well, since you are computing the determinant of an operator, it might be more convenient to multiply this operator by minus I. It doesn't change the results, but it's better. So I write this as exponential of I times integral d for x of c bar a of x times
minus d mu d mu minus f a b c. And here I have an a. Yes, here I have an a, and therefore I have a delta. Delta a c. So let us write this delta in front, because this is just a Kronecker product. So this is an index times d mu d mu minus f a b c d mu of a mu b of x c c of x. And I'm taking the and here I have I have a d mu of c c of x. Okay. So I write, and I have I am integrating over this big, and I'm closing the integral of the exponential. You see? So yes. Yes. Yeah, the derivative acts to the right, so it acts both on A and C. Otherwise, I would have put it on under parenthesis. Okay. It is d mu of this rule field. See? Acts both on A and C. But you can integrate by part formally and write a plus operator acting on the left and acting only on C bar. So it acts both on A and C, or only on C bar. Okay? Okay, so this seems a mathematical trick to compute it. And you see that those ghost and anti-ghost field, they carry a group indices, so they carry a charge. They carry charge, but no spin. So they are scalar, spin zero field, anti-commuting zero field. And of course, that's very bad, because you expect that you will have problems, because the spin statistic theorem is violated. Those fields doesn't satisfy the spin statistic commutation relation. Spin zero, but Fermi statistics. Okay. But they are here just as auxiliary field to compute a functional integral, and it's the final results of the functional integral, which has to make sense and which has to be gauge invariant. Okay. So now, you see, if I do that, I've replaced my original functional integral by dA, an integral over dA, an integral over C bar and C. And I have now a new action. I have the delta function, delta of f of a, okay? Still have my gauge fixing condition. Gauge fixing. And now you have an action, which is the sum of the gauge part plus the C C bar part, the ghost. Okay, so the gauge part of the action depends only on A, depends on A, and the ghost part depends on C, C bar, and A, because there is a coupling here. These terms, here you have a term which is of the form C bar, or if you want, D C bar A, C, and with some structure constant F. F, A, B, C, and if I am right, I have C, A, B, C, C, D, mu. Well, let us put the index like that. So you have a coupling between the gauge field and the ghost field. But this coupling is present only if the FABC are different from zero, namely if the group is non-abelian. So if G is non-abelian. So those, this subtlety, yes? So here I have saying that the D mu, I have just used make a partial integration to have the d mu acting on the C-bar. So you see that you need to introduce the ghost field only when the determinant is non-trivial, and the determinant is non-trivial if the group field is non-abelian. If the group, for quantum electrodynamics, you still have the determinant. But this determinant is just the Laplace operator. So its determinant is completely independent of the gauge field, so you can take it out of the functional integral as well. Okay. So now, what are the Feynman rules for this field theory? One last, I can stop there. But I will do one last trick. Let me explain it here. One last trick. But it's not a trick which is as deep as this trick of introducing anti-commuting auxiliary field. I am considering F, which is of the form, remember, my F of A is of the form dA minus omega in a compact way. Okay? So I expect that since I'm quantizing things in a gauge invariant way, I expect, and you can do the calculation and prove that the result, the integral, the functional integral is independent of the choice of omega. You can choose any function omega you want and give the same result. This is because of gauge invariance. Okay? So, instead of taking a fixed omega, I can integrate over the omegas, but in a very simple way. So let me, so this depends on omega, you see. So in some sense, I can write this as an F depending on omega. And let me multiply just by a function of omega. I will not change up to a global factor the integral. So I will introduce integral of d omega exponential of minus I times integral d4x omega squared over 2 times a factor that I called xi. Okay? So this is, of course, this is a constant. This is a big infinite constant. And what does this mean? In fact, that I'm integrating over all points of space, over all group indices. Remember that omega has a component, d omega a of x. And then this means exponential of minus I times integral d4x omega a of x omega a of x divided by 2 zeta, where this zeta is just a real number. So it still fixes some kind of gauge. And if you are doing that, introduce this integral into delta omega, then I can write that d omega exponential minus I times d4x omega squared over 2 omega. And here I have a delta function of dA minus omega, yes? Pardon?
Omega squared over 2
psi. Oh, I'm sorry. 2 psi. Yes? And here you have a delta function of omega minus something. So you see that this becomes obviously, simply, the exponential of minus I times integral over d4x of dA squared over 2 psi. You see? So this means that I can freely add to this a term of the form minus 1 over 2 psi d4x d mu a mu a of x squared in the action. Okay? What? And this has disappeared. You see? So I have replaced the gauge fixing condition fixing that d omega, dA is equal to omega by I'm weighting dA. Yes?
So you said that adding this thing to the action is,
yes,
like multiplying the half integral by a constant.
Yes.
But you also have the delta function, right? So when you, it's not clear to me that's actually just adding.
Okay, no. This integral is a constant.
Right.
Okay.
So
now I introduce this integral at any point. And then I make the integration. So here I have, if I make the integration of omega A being fixed without this term, this is one. So now I can average over omega and integrate over A and not over omega. I integrate over omega, and then I have no, if I integrate over omega having put this, then I just get this. You see, now what I'm doing is that here I have a big integral which depends on the choice of omega. So I have a big integral z of omega. Then I but I know it's independent of omega. Of omega. So I introduce my integral over my term of something like that before that. Then I interchange the integral over omega and the integral over A. So instead of having an integral over d omega and an integral over A, I said that this is an integral over A and an integral over omega. And the integrand here depends on omega. Once you integrate over I, it's independent of omega. So now if I can intervert the two integration, here the integrand depends on omega. So if I integrate over omega, I get something non-trivial depending on A.
So we are using the assumption that z is actually independent of omega.
Yes.
Crucially.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's why we can just say that VL is multiplying it.
Yes. Yes. We are using everywhere in those manipulation the fact that the integral is independent of gauge transformation. Okay. So once you do, we have done that. What do we have? Which final action do we have? We have first the gauge fixing term, and remember the gauge fixing term, it had mu, it had d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So the gauge fixing term had minus 1 over 4 g squared, that was a factor I, times in the action we had a d mu. Well, let us just write the action. We add d mu a nu a minus d nu a mu a squared. Squared means that I'm summing all the mu, all the nu's, and all the a. And in addition, I add a minus. Pardon? No, no, but the commutator of a comes later. I'm just keeping the term which have order a squared. And then I had a minus 1/2 of zeta. I can change the definition of zeta by adding a zeta g squared, if you want. It's not a problem, so I can get the 1 over g squared in front of that. Minus 1 over 2 zeta times d mu a mu squared. Okay, then I had the term coming from the commutator a mu a nu. So I had minus 1/2 of d mu a nu minus d nu a mu times a mu a nu, and here I have some indices f a f b f c f a b c, and I have an f a b c coming from the commutator, representing the commutator. And then I had a minus 1 over 4, a term which involves two commutators. So I have an F A B C E F C F C D E A mu A A mu B A mu C A mu D, something like that. So this is a term which is already present in QED, because so this means that now if I multiply, remember, we multiply the field A by defining that this is GA, then this is a term of order 1, this is a term of order G, this is a term of order G squared. So this means that this is the integration, so this means that we have a propagator for the gauge field, which is the propagator for the photon, except that the photon now is a gauge field which carries charge indices. So it carries both a Lorentz index for the spin and an A index for the charge. But the propagator will be simply, if you want, now if you go to momentum space, So I'm computing the two-point function at leading order for an A mu carrying a momentum k. And I get, in fact, minus I over k squared and minus I epsilon plus if I'm taking care of the Feynman prescription. And then I have an h mu nu. H mu, let us write it, h mu nu plus zeta minus 1 k nu over k squared. So this is a propagator for the gauge and gauge field. And of course, I just have in front of that a delta AB, which means that the propagation of a gauge field in the vacuum doesn't change the charge. The charge is conserved. And this is the general form of the propagator of a gauge field, so a gauge vector particle, in this special gauge, which is a gauge characterized by element psi. Okay. And for instance, I presume that in a quantum electrodynamic course, we have studied a special gauge where we enforce the fact that dA equals 0. dA equals 0 means that you force omega to be equal to 0. You can force it by enforcing that psi is equal to 0, so forcing the Lorentz gauge, d mu a mu equals 0 is equivalent to set psi equals 0. And here then you get h mu nu minus k nu over k squared, a tensor like that, depending on k, which is the projector on transverse polarization states. I mean, if you assume that you have a gauge field which is of the form, for instance, A mu equal epsilon mu times exponential I kx, if you take a plane wave like that, this projects you on the stage so that the polarization epsilon mu times k mu equals 0, which are the transverse states. And you see that if you change psi, you add something, but you add something which modifies only the propagation of the longitudinal modes. So these are the transverse state, transverse polarization states. And changing psi modifies only the propagation of the so-called longitudinals states, which are unphysical. Yes?
Is the value of psi other than 1?
Yes.
We have longitudinal modes in the propagator?
Yes. But, and the propagation depends on psi. But the point is that when you compute amplitudes using those Feynman rules, in fact, they will disappear at the end. And because the results cannot depend on psi, because the theory is gauge invariant. And therefore, if during some intermediate calculation you have contribution depending on psi, they will cancel out at the end, and we shall see how they do. Okay, so this is a propagator for the field. So this is a term which is present as well for QED than for non-abelian gauge theories. Okay, and then we have the two boson vector operator, which is of the form of, you see, on the general form, there is a dA, there is an A, there is an A, and there is an F. F for coupling, for a structure constant. So it's non-zero for U2. And you have this term, this four boson terms, which contains an A, an A, an A, an A, and the products of two structure constants. Okay, and so which contains a bit complicated structure, both for the spin, because the particle exchange spins, they exchange momenta, they exchange spins, and they exchange charges. Okay. So now we have the ghost field in addition. We have those seemingly strange ghost field. Yes? Oh, yes, and this is, of course, of order times G. And this is order G squared. So you see that G measures the strength of the interaction. Now you have the ghost field. So this is the part for the gauge field. Now you have the ghosts. And what are the Feynman rules you can deduce for the ghost? First, you have a kinetic term in the ghost, which is simply C bar. You get the term which is of the form I C bar minus the ordinary Laplacian times C, if you want, integrated over x. So this means that you have a ghost propagator that you can, and remember the ghost carry charges. So in fact, if I'm computing the expectation value in the vacuum of CA of x, C bar B of y, exactly as I was doing for the Fermi field, then I get something which in Fourier space or momentum space reads. So I will represent this by just by the same rules than for the Fermi field, the standard notation for the propagator for fermions. You know, this is a propagator where I go from a C to a C bar. So this is a C, this is a C bar. The euro goes from ghost operator to anti-ghost operator. Remember that the ghost carry charge indices. The ghost field are charged as the gauge field. They carry no spin, so there are no Dirac or Lorentz indices. And the propagator is simply, in momentum states, minus I times k squared minus I epsilon, if this momentum carry, the ghost field carries a four momentum k, and I have a delta AB. Okay? So the ghost, this is the propagator of a massless boson, okay? Except that this is a fermions. So this is a propagator for a massless spin zero particle, but a fermions and not a boson. Yes? I mean, it's a fermion. It means that all the creation and annihilation operator anti-commute. Okay. So for instance, if you compute C bar A of X, C A, C B of Y, you will get minus C B of Y, C bar A of X, with a minus sign. Okay, so it obeys, when you apply Vick's theorem, so this means that if you encounter ghost and anti-ghost field in your calculation, take the propagator to be the propagator of the massless spin zero particle, but when applying the Vick's theorem, so it means that the propagator is the same than
big theorem, but when you plug big theorem, take the rules for the fermions. So add the minus one sign when you permute two fields. Okay. And so now so this is the propagator for the ghost. But in addition, we have an interaction term between the ghost, the anti-ghost, and the gauge field. This means that in addition, we have a vertex, and let us write it a little bit more carefully. and let me. So these terms, which was written here, since I have changed this, so I will have a term which will be of the form I G, because I multiply A by threshold G, F ABC, integral over 4x, F ABC, D mu C bar A mu B C C. And the D mu acts on C bar A. Okay, so what it means? It means that this describes an interaction where you have a ghost field propagating, and I represent the ghost by a dashed line. So this propagator describes the propagation from a ghost which carries a momentum C, charge C, to an anti-ghost carrying a charged A, but it interacts with a gauge field carrying a charged B and some spin, so some Lorentz indices mu. Okay? And if here you have a momentum P carried by the incoming ghost, if you have a momentum K carried by the incoming gauge field, this carries a momentum, let us say, Q equal P plus K by momentum conservation. Yes?
The arrows, have you painted them from C to C bar now?
The arrow goes from C to C bar exactly like here. So okay. This is why here there is a charge in this C, and here there is a charge in this A. Okay? Okay? And you see that, so what is the factor associated to this vertex? You have a factor, a coupling constant G. You have an F, A, B, C. And you have, since you have a derivative, you have a factor I times the momentum Q, a minus I times the momentum Q, because the incoming momentum is minus Q. And therefore you get, if I am right, get a factor minus G times Q mu. I'm not completely sure about the sign, but it's not very important because in the calculation you have always an even number of. Okay. So you see, you have the propagator for the. This is the propagator for the ghost, and this is the interaction for the ghost and the ghost. So you have an interaction, and you see that through this interaction. The ghost exchange charges with the gauge boson. And it exchanges momentum, and the momentum exchange depends on the spin of the particle.
Okay, so, not much time. So now, you see that the rules in general are more complicated because, for instance, let us compute what are the Feynman rules when you consider the propagation of a gauge boson. Propagation of the gauge boson at tree level at this time by a graph like that. Then go to one loop level. Go to term of order. So this is tree level. This is standard perturbation theory. Go to one loop level. To one loop level, you have. Okay, I'm considering a pure gauge field, so I have no fermions. But you can, the rules, if you add matter fields like fermions, Dirac fields, the rules are not modified. Because the action of a Dirac field coupled to a gauge field is gauge invariant. Okay, so in a, so if you want to have fermions, you will have, if you want to have fermions, psi, and remember psi, psi I and psi bar I, where I goes from 1 to the dimension of the representation in which the boson field. You have a propagator for the fermions. They go from psi to psi bar, which is the usual Dirac propagator. And you have an interaction between the gauge field, which is given by the usual coupling. So there is a gamma coupling, and there is a coupling because here you have so the fermions carry a spin index, a Dirac index, and a charge index, but which belongs now to the dimension of the representation. So here you have an I index, you have a G index, you have an alpha, you have a beta. And the gauge field contains a mu index and an A index, where A belongs to the adjoint representation of the field. And so you have a standard coupling of the form. You have a gamma mu AB. And here you have to take into account the fact that you have to consider the representation in the representation R of the matrix element A, and you take the, this is alpha beta, sorry. So you take the matrix element IG of the representative in the representation R of the generator TA associated to the index of the gauge field. Okay, so things that we wrote already yesterday, okay? So, but let us assume that you have no fermions, so it's pure gauge field. Then, because the gauge field is interacting with itself, you have diagrams like that. So a gauge field can create a pair of two virtual gauge fields, which annihilates, which gives the gauge field. So it's the analog of a photon creates a pair of a fermion and antifermions, which annihilate. Okay, but you have also this term, so you also have a diagram with that you will recognize as same for gauge field as the tadpole diagram for the phi 4 interaction, and that's because there is an A 4 interaction. Okay, so now there are a lot of indices of group indices and spin indices traveling in those diagrams, so it's a bit complicated, and I don't write them because I have no time. But you have to, so you say, okay, that's okay, this is interaction at one loop. These are the diagrams which comes out. But remember, you have also the ghosts, and the ghosts interact with the fermionic field. So you can create also a pair of a ghost and anti-ghost, which annihilates So you have this additional diagram, and if you don't, if you forget to take into account this diagram in the perturbative calculation, the results will not be gauge invariant. And you will be in trouble. And moreover, remember, there is a one loop. This is a one loop fermion operator. So there is a minus sign coming from the fact that the ghosts are fermions. You see? So, in some sense, this amplitude is here to cancel out some of the amplitudes, part of it. You see? And in fact, remember, I've explained to you that in the propagator here, the propagator for the gauge field is the usual propagator we expect for transverse polarization state, but it behaves more strangely and in a gauge-dependent way for longitudinal polarization state. And in this diagram, they describe the creation of virtual particles. You see? So the rules of quantum mechanics tells you that if you have a physical state here, which satisfies the conservation of momentum and energy, for instance, you have p squared equal minus m squared coming in, this comes out in the correct way. And if you have a gauge field, so a photon, if you want a photon with a transverse polarization coming in it, so you will have a photon coming out with a transverse polarization. But in between, you may have states, well, contribution in the function. If you want to interpret the contribution of this Feynman integral in terms of intermediate states, those states are not necessarily physical. They are off-shell. So for instance, they do not necessarily need to have e squared, well, p squared minus e squared equal minus m squared. And they do not necessarily have the right polarization, which is a physical polarization. So in this contribution, you have a contribution of transverse plus longitudinal states here and here. And it turns out that if you compute this and this, some of the contribution of the longitudinal states cancel. For instance, the contribution coming from the Xi term cancel because the results, the final result is known to depend on Xi. But some of the contribution coming from this K mu, K mu, K squared term do not cancel. And it's a big problem because, for instance, they give negative probabilities. Etc. So problem with unitarity. So unitarity seems to be violated. Yes?
Is it the longitudinal
mode or the time-like mode that's creating the problem? I'm using the term longitudinal modes for the modes which are not transverse, okay, namely, you see, I'm not sure I have time. Can answer in private. Okay. The longitudinal modes are not the modes which are the modes which are not the two transverse modes. You have two transverse modes, and you have two longitudinal modes, which are the two other polarizations. You have four polarizations possible. Okay, but in fact, they are cancelled out. Cancelled by the ghost contribution. So the ghost makes a good job. They cancel out the contribution of dangerous and physical contribution in the calculation. And it's not a miracle, because the ghost came because we want to quantize in a consistent way, in a gauge invariant way. So they are intermediate in the calculus. which makes the result gauge invariant and physically consistent. And if you want to interpret everything in these Feynman rules in terms of particles, the ghost can be viewed as some physical particle with a wrong statistic, which cancel out the contribution of the unphysical modes, which leads to negative probability. And that's not a surprise, because the condition for the, where was it written? Here. The condition for the spin statistic theorem to hold, you require Lorentz invariance, in fact, Poincaré invariance, plus unitarity, and plus some slightly more technical, for instance, you need some properties of the vacuum, which states that, in fact, the vacuum is Lorentz invariance, is unique, etc. But basically, the spin statistic theorem holds, in general, for quantum theory, which are relativistically invariant and unitary. And which means that since the ghosts are spin zero particles but fermions, if you try to construct a quantum field theory, what is the Hilbert space associated to the, you take the vacuum and you apply creation and annihilation operator described by those C and C bars in the functional integral formalism, you build out a space of states, which is not an Hilbert space because it has negative norm states. So the ghosts are not unitary. But the quantum field theory described by ghost system is very interesting. It has a lot of mathematical properties which are used in many areas of physics and of mathematics, but it's not a unitary quantum field theory. And those non-unitary contributions cancel out the non-unitary contribution coming out from the non-transverse states. And at the end, you get something sensible. So I just explained the general mechanism. I gave no proof, but there are beautiful mathematical theory which explains how this works, and not only at one loop, but at two or three loops, etc. Yes?
Cancel some of the infinities to basically do some renormalization?
Using some fictitious particle?
Fictitious.
Fictitious particle?
Like ghosts.
In general, not really, I think, because if you have a fictitious particle, it means that it's non-unitary. And the ultraviolet divergence in quantum field theory, in fact, are valid even if the theory is. If you want to cancel them, you have to cancel them by physical particles, which means they have to be very high energy, high mass particles. So it means change the high energy physics of the theory by adding, for instance, non renormalizable terms, but you have to keep them physical. So it's a different mechanism. But it's not black magic. That's what I want. Okay, so thank you. And tomorrow, I will start to discuss, but in a few minutes, some of the physical properties of gauge theory, which came out of this format. Thank you.